Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Lamis Abdelati from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Today, I'll be talking to Sumitha Pawa about her book, Politics is Worship, Righteous Activism and the Egyptian Muslim Brothers, which was published by Syracuse University Press in 2023. Sumitha, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Okay, well, I'm a political scientist, but trained in a very multidisciplinary and a pretty constructivist department. I teach at Scripps College in California. My main interest is in social movements and religion and politics more broadly. This book is based in part on my dissertation research, which compared Egypt and India. And I am from India, but I spent about 5 years in Egypt.
Fantastic. So you've already told us that this book was based on your dissertation, but how did you come to be interested in this topic?
It was pretty accidental. I was interested in the Middle East. I was studying abroad in France as an undergraduate, and I took a class on Middle East politics, and I was assigned a presentation on the Muslim Brothers. This is also the era where Islamism as the new threat was very present in political science. It's the late 1990s. And I was very fascinated by how popular and religious legitimacy worked in the brothers' work. I read Gilles Kepel and a lot of the French 1980s work on Islamism. And once I started graduate school, Carrie Wickham's work on the Muslim Brothers and social movement approaches to Islamism were just becoming more popular. So I suppose that's how I got into the topic. I also mentioned this was originally comparative work with India. So I was also broadly more interested in thinking about religion as a source of mobilization, but also as a source of change, not something that's static, not something that is, contained within institutions necessarily.
So what is your central argument in this book? Okay.
I suppose the central argument is that religious ideas, as mobilized by Islamists, are not necessarily things that remain contained within movement books and texts. They're very active. They're a site of dynamism. And more broadly, if we look at how these ideas have been mobilized by the Muslim Brothers and by Islamists generally over time, we don't necessarily see one directional change. We don't see that electoral politics is the only thing driving their evolution. I think we actually need to look at, and I argue this in the book, how politics itself can be a site through which Islamists believe that they are pursuing their religious mission, hence the title of the book, Politics as Worship.
It's such a fantastic title. So in the book, you draw on this very wide range of sources. Would you mind just sharing with listeners what sort of research you did for the book?
Okay, so this is a very constructivist and interpretivist approach. And when I started out, what I really wanted to understand was how exactly the Muslim Brothers, who had started to engage in electoral politics in the 1980s, and then later on, when I was starting my research in 2005, were getting more involved in parliamentary politics. I really wanted to understand how they understood what they were doing, and not just to assume, as I think was common for all of us at the time, that the literature tended to focus on the movement to party process. Of course, the brothers are going to, drop everything that they were doing or sideline religious activism, dawah, preaching, right, grassroots activism, and move towards electoral politics. And, there was this assumption there was going to be a split in the movement. There were the people who cared a lot about dawah and preaching and religious work and who were wary of politics. And then there were people who were completely all in on politics, and they were the ones sort of moving the movement away from the grassroots. But what I wanted to understand was, why is it that many of those people who were participating in politics did not see it that way? And just for a a quick sort of intro as to where I got this idea. When I interviewed Samuel Erien and I was trying to understand first how the brothers defined what they were doing differently and understood their mission differently as they moved through all these different political spheres, he looked at me kind of funny and said, well, why do you think we're doing things differently? Everything I do is worship. I didn't quite understand what he was saying at the time, but gradually I realized I needed to do more to understand it. So initially, I ideally wanted to do ethnographic work to understand how these activists, you know, did their research, sorry, did their political work. I didn't really have the language skills or the contacts and the level of trust that I needed to do it. So I used documents to find out how they were talking about this in different ways. So, you know, more written documents at first, some interviews. So there were two stages of the research. One was when I was doing my dissertation research, where I focused on trying to find articles that people wrote, speeches that they made, what they wrote in internal publications, such as were available in the Islamist press or in other sources, to understand how they presented what they were doing, both internally and externally, as part of an overall mission. So that was one set of sources. Later on, when I went back to Egypt after 2011, I had the misfortune to be finishing my dissertation in 2011, and therefore I had to redo everything. When I went back, there was a little bit more openness, and I was actually able to talk to more people. There were more mid-level activists and student activists who were willing to talk to me. So then I did a lot more interviews. And this was also the era when, in that brief moment of openness, Ikhwan Wiki started. And instead of having to, you know, dive through bookstores inside the Zainab and have people look at you funny because you wanted to, you know, buy this book on Tarbiyah, you could actually get a lot of materials from the Ikhwan Wiki. You could download the PDFs. And this is also when I was able to access some training curricula. So the approach and the methods overall are interpretivist. They use texts and interviews. It's what some people call interpretivist approaches with an ethnographic sensibility, where I'm trying to understand how people in the movement, particularly in positions of influence, understand what they're doing and how they communicate this to others within the movement. So the goal is also to see how people don't just understand things as individuals who are members of a movement, but how this feeds back into movement socialization, how it changes what the movement believes it can do in the future.
So let's dive into the empirical chapters. So you begin with the beginnings of the movement, basically, and kind of trace it through to the 1970s. What do you find there?
In the beginning, I was actually surprised at how much reference to political work there was, and in some ways how similar it was to what we saw more recently. So Hassan al-Banna, who was the founder of the Muslim Brothers, you know, he starts out as a school teacher. He is anti-colonial, but he's also focused on building the new Muslim man. And I was very taken by how much he emphasized tarbiyah, or education or upbringing, not surprising because he was a teacher, but also the extent to which he saw this as central to the political mission. It's a bottom-up approach. This is what another scholar, Hisham Kadir, has called the trickle-up approach. And Banna centered his argument for the goals and the mission of the Brotherhood by focusing on this idea of tarbiyah, education. You're educating not just movement members, but you're educating the public more widely to see Islam as something that has to be applied, as something they have to live, and that's as something that cannot really be separated from politics. So in this chapter, I really focused on understanding how the concept of righteous action was developed within Banna's thought of Amal al-Saleh. And because of this concept of action, the references to religious texts and models for what you're supposed to do in politics was in some sense ambiguous. There was a very strategic but a self-conscious process of framing what you had to do. It's not an ideology that's written down for once and for all. And Banna didn't intend that either. Even when people refer back to his letters, people refer back to his ideas, they're always required to say, well, if you want to work for God, what does this tell us to do? what is the setting in which you have to apply this? And how are we as a movement going to go through the process of trying to figure this out? So my main takeaway over here was there were some key concepts. There was some key terms that were used that came up again and again. One was the concept of tarbiyah. You have to educate not just yourself, but others. And it's a practical tarbiyah, right? You're doing this by working in politics. It's not something that just ends at some point. It's not something that you do only at home. The second concept was that of applying Sharia. And in this sense, you're not actually applying Sharia through laws. This is something else that I think many of us didn't necessarily understand earlier. The idea of applying Sharia was to achieve a broadly defined sense of social justice. And laws were part of the process. There was also a lot of talk over here about being an active Muslim and what it means to be a committed Muslim. So there were all these concepts that were folded into the brothers' training. And there was a very strong social aspect to it. You were required to cultivate these skills in yourself and others through the usra system, which is like a cell or a family system for the brothers, but you were also required to do things in external spheres. So the relationship between the movement sphere and the public sphere was always one of educating others, was always one of like reaching out and expanding your circles to spread what you were doing in wider and wider spheres. And politics, as an electoral politics, could potentially be useful for that. But politics was not a sphere in which you were required to drop your commitments. Right? Politics was something you conditionally accepted, you used conditionally and strategically to achieve your overall goals.
So after that, sort of the next step is you move to the 1980s and you trace how the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood engaged with electoral politics. Tell us about that.
Okay, so electoral participation was something that the brothers actually really struggled with, which is something else that I think I wasn't expecting given what we had learned about, inclusion moderation, and surely you would want access to power if you have these broader political goals. And the reason that they struggled with it was because of the idea of pluralism. And Hassan al-Banna had also been very skeptical of political pluralism that could potentially lead people away from God. And even within the Brotherhood in the late 1970s and early 1980s, when initially Sadat and later Mubarak said we're going to allow more multi-party competition, there was a lot of internal disquiet around this idea. There was, the leader of the movement at the time, Omar Tilmesani, was in favor of electoral participation, but it wasn't a purely strategic thing, right? In part, what the brothers wanted to do was to say, we can use this to strengthen our movement. So a lot of what we might assume about electoral politics helping Islamists gain access to the tools that will allow them to implement some pre-decided or preordained goals wasn't necessarily the way it worked. What I found was that the brothers had to do a lot of internal and external persuasion. Internally, there was a lot of skepticism around how politics was corrupting and distracting. Politics might require you to work with people who were non-religious or anti-religious. It might also force you to legitimize a government that had pretended to work for religious goals but had not. This is also the era when Sharia is put into the Egyptian constitution as the main source of legislation. And Mubarak is trying to use this as a way of saying, this is a state that upholds Sharia. So the leadership had to, do this very fine balancing act to say we should participate in electoral politics. And the way that they did it was to say, what we're doing is actually religion. This was useful both internally and externally. Internally, you're telling people that electoral work is an extension of dawah or preaching. This is just a new setting in which you're going to do what you've already done. So that the way that worked was that the brothers presented vote seeking as a moral endeavor. When you went out to persuade people to participate in electoral politics, it wasn't because you thought you could actually win the election. That wasn't going to be possible because this is competitive authoritarianism. What you were doing was cultivating your own ethical skills and persuading people to see what you were doing as, in some sense, standing up for Islam in a new sphere. You were able to use Parliament as a pulpit, right? You were able to use electoral politics and campaigning as a form of persuasion to persuade people to see good works that you might be able to do as a politician, as a sign that Islam could be a solution in the long term. So why participate in rigged elections? It's a kind of ethical praxis, right? You were standing up for the voice of Islam, which was also framed as the voice of the believing people in Parliament, and you weren't going to allow people who were spiritually corrupt to dominate the sphere, which was supposed to represent the sphere of the people. The we're just doing religion approach was also helpful in persuading outsiders. Now, the Brothers of the Stage actually formed a coalition with the Wafd Party, which is historically a secular political party in Egypt. And one of the ways that they persuaded them and persuaded others this was a legitimate thing to do was to say, we're fighting for a voice for people. We want to be sure that people who are believers aren't kept out of this political process because this is a country of believers. So one of the things that changes as they're doing this is that initially they started with this very like pedagogical approach, very top down. And they say, you know, if you are going to vote as people, voting is a religious act. We want to teach you how to make the right choice. Vote for people who are upright, people like us, but also anybody who is religiously upright. You're also telling people who are campaigning that they are cultivating their own spiritual skills in the process. Right? So this is like a mutually constitutive process of making people better Muslims. It's not actually about what you're going to gain at the end of the day in the political sphere. You're cultivating this broader religious public, ensuring them that they're required to act in politics for their religious goals. Later on, the brothers started to, you know, by the late 1980s, appeal to people to say that you have this ethical obligation to vote in a certain way, but you're also, you know, the great Egyptian people, and you should stand up for your rights as people who have a voice in this country. So there's a subtle shift over here between appealing to people to say, you're not good enough Muslims, you should be better Muslims, to say, you know, we know that you're already good Muslims, here's what you're supposed to do. The end result of this process was actually not that the brothers made a lot of gains in Parliament. The biggest impact was really on the movement itself. By the late 1980s, we see in the new Tarbiya, in the internal training texts, that there is a deeper understanding and a greater consensus around the idea that electoral politics would not be corrupting because it was actually going to allow believers to have a greater voice, and it was actually going to crowd out the voices of unbelievers in Parliament.
So the next step that the book takes is looking at debates around the application of Sharia during the period from 1985 to 1990. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes. This is actually the period where we see the brothers develop a political project that looks more like we would expect, you know, an Islamist project to look like. But surprisingly, they didn't start out thinking about law. They didn't start out thinking that the state was something that you could capture right away. Earlier on, they were deeply skeptical of this idea because you had to prepare society religiously before you could, you know, attempt to gain political power. But what happened in the late 1980s was that there was some pressure from within the Egyptian ruling party to, quote unquote, ensure that legislation was Sharia compliant. Again, because of Article 2 jurisprudence and so on. So they're in Parliament. A couple of things are going on. The representatives from the ruling party are taking on some cases that the Supreme Constitutional Court has referred to them for Sharia compliance because the Constitutional Court says, this is not our job. You guys need to take this on. And Egypt has also started to take loans from the IMF, which required a lot of economic change. And, you know, there are interest-bearing loans. There's some economic liberalization going on and so on. So you have brothers in Parliament who are now not just speaking for Muslims, but they're also thinking about and grappling with the idea of what it means to use their power. Right, their very limited power in Parliament to apply or to implement Sharia. Now, the term application implementation, tatbik, or tanfidh, these are not terms the brothers start using. These are actually terms that are initially used by the ruling party. And the brothers are, in a sense, responding to them. So there's an interesting shift over here where brotherhood representatives in parliament, and by the late 1980s, they had formed another coalition with a former somewhat more leftist populist party that had got more Islamist. When they were voting on state policies, they were actually starting to realize that they had to be seen as the voice of Islam on these policies, because the state was trying to say, don't worry, Allah's her, the main state established religious institution, which has historical roots, Allah's her is going to decide whether something is Sharia compliant or not. So in order to stand up for and present themselves as the voice of the believers in parliament, they had to say something about this. There are also some laws and debates and, you know, policy debates around criminal law, which, you know, they do have strong and clear opinions on. But broadly, they focused on how and why social justice and religious rules about, you know, economic justice were or were not being applied by the government. So this is the period where the idea of rule or political power as something that could help you, even before you had collectively prepared society with, you know, making everyone religious first, this is when that idea starts to take hold in brotherhood discourse. Again, this is both internal and, you know, in what they're saying in parliament. And we see a couple of different things happen. We see an acceptance of the idea that you could and should work with state institutions on things like economic policy to achieve justice, even if these institutions were not quite Islamic yet. And in part, this is because coercive power and government power affected the ability of Muslims to live their lives. So this is the shift. Instead of saying, you know, build that pious public so they can pressure the government, they're now saying, we actually are in a position where we can pressure the government. We can determine how they're going to use their power. We can determine how they're going to use their policymaking power, their economic power, and so on. And they can use it for good or evil. And it's our job to ensure that they use it for good. So at this stage, they start to really grapple with the idea of what it means to potentially seek political power, and what it means to have a state that's supposed to be governed according to God's law, but that is not actually allowing people who are true believers to have a voice. So interestingly, even as they're becoming more comfortable with the idea of political power and using the state and maybe lobbying to change laws to make them more religiously sound, they still say that there is no implementation of Sharia except by the will of the street. And they also say that what we need to do is actually to increase shura consultation to pressure the government. Al-Azhar is not sufficient because Al-Azhar is co-opted. Right? Al-Azhar maybe needs to have a directly represented senior council in order to be able to stand up for religious policies. So again, this is an interesting period because this is where for the first time you actually have policies that are defined as Islamic show up in the brothers' talk. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it is still about helping people be good Muslims, right? They haven't lost track of that. So these different elements of what it means to act for God are mobilized at different times to justify different policies and choices, but it doesn't represent to the movement a shift. They don't sort of see this as having embraced politics for its own sake. This is politics insofar as it can help us in our overall mission of tarbiyah and of Islamizing society.
Thank you for that. After that, you move to the period from the mid-1990s to the early 2000s. What patterns do you uncover there?
Okay, this is when the brothers were actually out of electoral politics for a little while, out of parliamentary politics, and then there was another cycle where they were jailed. And yet there was some liberalization in other spheres of life. So for instance, syndicates, professional syndicates, were a site in which the brothers participated. This is what Gary Wickham has researched and written about in great detail. They realized at this point that even if parliamentary power wasn't something that, you know, was going to get them what they wanted, they had to be very pragmatic about other forms of institutional power. This is also when a new generation of brothers that had spent some time in the Gulf comes back. This is when Khaled al-Shatir returns to Egypt, and he is, you know, somebody who had spent time, you know, making money in the Gulf and was a businessman. But this is a time where the brothers really internally grapple with the idea that they are not probably going to, you know, achieve social Islamization anytime soon. And that gradual approach that said, you know, cultivate people, make sure that you've educated them before they will ask for the application of Sharia. Well, that's probably not going to happen. So what do we do? So a couple of other concepts that were present within the brothers' ideas of how to act for Islam become more salient at this point. The idea of commanding the right al-amr bil ma'ruf, which is actually a religious concept that says that, you know, people in positions of power are supposed to do this. This was something they had broadened to what everybody was required to do. So as soon as you are ethically, you know, at the right position, you are required to, in every sphere of your life, you know, make sure that you use whatever power you have to command what's right. That's a concept that we see emerging at this stage. Another one is the idea of tamkeen or empowerment, which also was somewhat problematic for the government because they framed this as, you know, the brothers having revolutionary plans. But the way that tamkeen or empowerment or in a sense capacity building worked for the brothers here was they stepped back and they said, okay, we might not have the Islamic State right away. What we can have is the ability to use different forms of social power. So if, for instance, you were in a position to endow a hospital, maybe if you, you know, were somebody who worked in, you know, an office and you had a charitable collection in your office, here's a space in which you can use the fact that you're a righteous, good Muslim to build social and institutional support for your cause. So the reframing that happens over here is that institutions that were not necessarily parliament could also be institutions where you did dawah, where you did religious outreach. Also, you weren't just persuading people through your words and by being a good role model, you were also using economic and institutional resources to essentially show them what you could achieve. So if you could, for instance, empower God's word or empower the mission in society by taking, you know, taking control of a syndicate, getting elected over there, using its resources to help people do good. Maybe they had conferences about, you know, Islamic medicine, Islamic education. They did a lot of these things in the syndicate. If you were to do this, you were then creating a new sphere in which you could do dawah. So this was an interesting shift in part because earlier there had been some skepticism of using institutions that were in other ways corrupt or were not Islamic to begin with. Earlier you were supposed to use mosques, you were supposed to use institutions that were, you know, where people were required to be good Muslims. And over here in this period, we see that the leadership says, you know, what's really going to be helpful for us is that you build your skills in these other institutions, you use these other institutional powers. Again, it comes back to Tarbiyah, however. You're using these institutional forms of power and these spaces not just to command the right and build your capacity to preach to others, but you're also building your own skills as a good Muslim activist in things like, you know, running meetings, consulting with others, fundraising. These are all skills that can ultimately serve the religious cause, that are ultimately going to go back to the movement and help strengthen the movement. So there's an expansion of the idea of what counts as righteous action in this period.
So finally, we get to the Arab Spring, you know, the period from 2011 and after. How does the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood frame political work during this time?
Okay. This actually reminds me that I missed something from the 2000s, which is actually a pretty interesting shift. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in 2004 and 2005, there was actually a huge churn within the movement where you had a group who were sort of the Wasatiyya activists who were the so-called moderates who said, we need to embrace politics and form a political party. And then you had the so-called conservatives who said, actually, we need to stay united and we need to be sure that any political work that we do remains within the movement's mission. And, you know, some of those activists were kicked out of the movement, but this is actually a stage where the conservatives decide we do need to formally include electoral politics and political work within our mission, and they change the internal training system. They come up with a more standardized curriculum about what it is that people are supposed to do in politics, which is actually going to end up mattering a great deal for those activists in 2011. So the curriculum that standardizes this point makes a case for why you first need to be trained in different kinds of religious education before you can participate in politics, right? Politics is too important to be left to just the politicians. It has to be left to people who are good Muslims. But also it frames electoral politics, political work, party work, all those skills that you gained in, you know, doing the work in syndicates and so on, as forms of ethical cultivation that we're going to get you into heaven, right? This is what's going to get you your salvation points. And the way that it was framed was you were actually rallying support for the cause through political work. If you gave money for political work, that was also a kind of jihad. If you were doing political work, it was also a kind of jihad. But also, more importantly, you were cultivating your own religious skills as someone who could work for Islam. So moving on to 2011, in the 2004-2005 curriculum, these sorts of skills were reserved for full members. Right? There's a process. You start out as a sympathizer and so on, and it takes a few years for you to become a full member. By 2011, when Mubarak is overthrown, the brothers are finally allowed to form a political party, there's a new curriculum that actually extends this to everybody. It's not just for the people who are the advanced members. Pretty much everyone is told that they have to and should participate in political work. Now, there was apparently a meeting where people were told, okay, make a choice. Do you want to participate in political work or not? Or do you want to sort of do the more social outreach? But most of the people I spoke to said, you know, in reality, most of us kind of had to because it was election time. So here's an interesting period where, you know, everybody thought, okay, they were allowed to form a political party. We're finally going to see what it is that they wanted from politics. What is the project? The brothers always talked about Islam being the solution, but because it always focused so much on action and on processes, not outcomes, right? It was not really the destination you were focused on. You were focused on getting everybody to be better Muslims. They finally had to put out a political project. They finally had to put out some statements about what it was that they wanted. And these statements and these goals were still pretty vague. Right? It was about Sharia's forms of social justice and working for Egypt and so on. But it wasn't so surprising when you consider that the idea that social and political work were meant to build religious credibility, build religious capital, build religious cultivation was actually cemented into the training at this point. So they had a new curriculum, which was called Working with Society, in which everybody was told that, you know, you weren't just trying to persuade people to vote for you so that you could achieve some preconceived goals. You were actually required to go out to people who may be unsympathetic to you. You were required to show them what a good Muslim looked like. You were required to, you know, have them realize that you were actually a good person, that the brothers were good Muslims, and they were going to prove that they were good Muslims because of everything they had done and continued to do, and that you were actually going to get a kind of support that was fundamentally religious. Right? You weren't being supported because of the outcomes. You were going to be supported because you were good people. So the messaging was very much, we do good for Egypt. The best people are those who help other people, and they're using hadiths as well in electoral campaigning in this way. It's interesting also to see the language of capital emerge at this point, right? So a lot of the activists that I spoke to would talk about the rasid, or the stock that they had with people. A lot of other political scientists have focused on how social networks and social services allowed the brothers to build social goodwill and was one of the reasons why people voted for them. And they did win a significant number of votes and formed a government in that first election. But part of what they were trying to do was not just to say, we're going to use this social capital to achieve our political goals. What they wanted to do and what they campaigned on was, we will also use government and what we can do in positions of government to essentially build our religious capital with a new group of people as well. So here are some of the consequences of that. One was that the political leadership that emerged in the party were actually the so-called organization men. These were the people who had been otherwise presumed to be conservative, but they wanted to keep the party united around the idea of the religious mission. This surprised a lot of people. Right? If you thought that they were leaving the religious mission and politics was ultimately the biggest prize, why wouldn't you have the political specialists, you know, take over? But no, this was not a primarily political project. It was ultimately still a religious project. Esamel Arian is the one who, you know, who sort of goes back and does party leadership work. But a lot of the people who were given tickets, electoral tickets for parliament, were not the people who had a lot of electoral experience. They were the people who were promoted within the movement as the so-called good people, right? You've proven yourself ethically, you've proven yourself in religious outreach. The next step is to persuade the wider public that they should vote for you. So the Tanzim, or the organization of the movement, was also very, very concerned with the idea that there might be splits. And this is also a period where a lot of the younger activists who were very frustrated with the hierarchical nature of the movement wanted to leave the movement, and they wanted a greater voice. A lot of people had expected this kind of split to happen around the question of politics versus preaching, but actually that's not the way it happened. And this is something that I think we also found surprising. And again, it was not as surprising when you realize that the party that they formed, the Freedom and Justice Party, was declared from the beginning to be a party that's going to serve our ideas and our wider mission, quote unquote, right? So getting more people to be involved in electoral politics was fundamentally predicated on the idea that what you were doing was actually not just politics. Right? It was something that was going to serve the mission, was going to serve preaching. The other thing that's important to over here is that the brothers made a lot of decisions and choices, responded to a lot of political incentives in a way that would allow them to uphold their vision of being the best Muslims. And here's where a new Salafi political party, and these are more conservative Islamists, posed a challenge to them, right? Because the Salafis were saying, we're actually going to implement elements of religious law, and we're actually, you know, more hardcore Muslims. So in electoral campaigning, the brothers actually had to make the case for why they were the best representatives of Islam. And in some electoral rallies, election rallies that I attended, and even if you sort of watch them in parliament, they were frequently trying to, you know, pit themselves against the Salafis to say, the Salafis are actually not going to implement Sharia because they don't understand Sharia. They think it's just law. They think it's just text. That's not it. The Ministry of Supply is Sharia. Doing good for the people is Sharia. Helping young men set up businesses. This is one thing that I heard Mursi say at a rally. This is going to be something that allows you to achieve the greater good. This is what we mean by Sharia, right? So they're positioning themselves, the people who have worked the longest for religion. They are positioning themselves as the people who will continue to work the longest. They will use the resources of state to do good for the people in a way that allows everybody to be a better Muslim. The Salafis are just going to do law, right? So this is a period where I think a lot of the decisions that the brothers made were not necessarily legible just purely in terms of electoral incentives. How they perceived and interpreted political opportunities had a great deal to do with what they saw as politics and the goal of politics. So once the brothers had been able to form a government of sorts and do the kinds of works that they thought were going to be good works, right? Implementing Sharia in a sense by making sure that people had bread, making sure that Egypt was producing enough and treating people fairly and so on and so forth, they still faced a lot of opposition. And this really posed a challenge because one of the goals of Politics for the Brothers was to show what just Islamic governance looked like so that people would be persuaded to vote for the Islamic cause and would be sort of drawn into the broader project of social Islamization. What happens then when your political project isn't terribly successful, isn't terribly popular or effective? What happens when people actually, you know, were not pleased with what you were doing? On the one hand, this led the brothers, some brothers, to say, there's a wider plot against us, right? And not completely wrong. Certainly the army and the intelligence services were somewhat bent on undermining them. But they could not really conceive of a world in which what they were doing, which was well-intentioned, well-meaning, a sign of their piety and a sign of wanting to do good for people, was not read as such. So when there were protests against them, and ultimately there was a somewhat popularly supported coup against Morsi in 2013, a lot of young brothers that I spoke to interpreted this in a number of different ways. One was that people were not religious enough. People were not educated enough to see what they were doing as just, right? So clearly politics had been either premature as something to have embraced power. Embracing power was a premature stage and they should have gone back and made sure to prepare society effectively. Or the other approach was to say that we actually should have had a revolution. You know, we shouldn't have played nice, you know, made piecemeal deals with people who weren't good Muslims. We actually did need to take over political power because that's what would allow us to show people what good governance looked like. We simply were not allowed. We were handicapped in doing this. And then this raised a lot of questions about how the brothers were going to understand legitimacy. This is another term that comes up in the brotherhood literature in the 2000s, Sharia. What does it mean to be legitimate? In election campaigning, they had claimed that they had legitimacy, not just because they were, you know, going to do things that would please God, but also because they had something of a mandate from people. And the two things went together. You couldn't have Sharia without your support for Sharia, without your support for God's will, because Egypt was a believing Muslim country, and surely that's what the majority wanted. But also you couldn't claim to represent God's will until the believing people supported you in doing so and sort of, you know, said that you were the best representatives to do so. So when the coup takes place, we see a real identity crisis in the brotherhood about what it means that they did not actually have popular support for what they were doing. Some of them believe that they could still and should still keep working at the grassroots, go back to sort of building social capital to convince people to support their project. Some believed that, you know, applying God's will on earth was something that was going to have to be, you know, have to go back to the private level and the family level. Some others were very, at this point, skeptical of the idea of putting the application of Sharia up to popular approval. Because what if the people simply weren't enlightened enough to be able to say that this is the way that you should run things? Many of them at this point recognized that if you were to make God's project and support for God's project contingent on political performance, that was always going to be risky, right? You were not in control of political performance. So it did lead to something of a rethinking of what it meant to, you know, tie your project to politics. It did not, however, change what people saw as, you know, the essential component of religion in the political process. You still had to pursue power, ensure that government was pious, ensure that those who were in positions of power over Muslims were also good Muslims. And I don't think it ultimately led them to, you know, undo all of their other commitments to politics. A lot of the writing that came out of this period, a lot of statements, did not say we're done with electoral politics. It was not, they were not saying that they had to sort of move away from all of their commitments of the 80s and the 90s. They really talked about different strategies, right? And one doesn't really see an approach to politics, even after the coup, that is understandable outside some of the reframings that had happened earlier about righteous action, about politics as a sphere that was either pious or impious and that should actually be Islamized.
So thinking more broadly, right, what would you say that this book or your findings tell us about religious mobilization in politics?
Okay. I think one of the first things that the book can do, one of the most important things, is to have us not think about religion as one thing, have us not think about Islamism as one thing, and certainly to not have us think about ideology as something that is written and is fixed. And what I mean by this is that a lot of the research on Islamism assumes that there's something of a founding period, and that ideas are fixed, and that something that's recognized and interpreted as religious is something that everybody would read in the same way. It seems a little bit paradoxical because, you know, Islamists like to say that their ideas are rooted in something that's unchanging and eternal. But because there is a very active element of having to interpret what religion says to see what you should do in a specific political context, there's always some dynamism in the process. So if we're thinking about how Islamist parties work, even when they have very, very similar ideas over time, those ideas and those concepts have different components that can be prioritized in different ways, applied in different ways, and there is no one fixed agenda. A lot of research that asks people why they might support Islamists, you know, codes people in terms of their piety by asking, you know, do you support the application of Sharia? How often do you pray? And we think we know what this indicates. But when we think about what's persuasive to people about Islamist projects, this isn't necessarily what they're hearing. They aren't hearing that Sharia just is, you know, the penal code. They're hearing that Sharia is all of these other things as well. If we're trying to understand why people might, you know, align with a movement or support a movement when they don't necessarily pray, we might be missing something here about how, you know, what it means to be a good Muslim and act for Islam has changed in the interpretation of Islamist movements. I think it's also interesting to think about how politics is not automatically the end goal for Islamist movements. It's not necessarily the site in which Islamist movements change the most. Politics is also a site of ethical cultivation for Islamist movements. Politics is part of a broader mission. So to separate out politics, to say, well, they're doing electoral politics now, clearly, you know, they're going to be very strategic, they're going to respond to incentives and, you know, pursue power at all costs, that's not necessarily the case. One other implication, I think, is looking at different Islamist movements, you might actually find that even with very similar ideas, for instance, movements in Morocco and in Tunisia, with very, very similar ideas about working for God, making sure that everything you do is godly, all your political work being something that, you know, is going to get you spiritual reward, even with very similar ideas in different contexts, interpretation matters. Movement interpretation matters. How these interpretations are sort of fed back into institutional socialization matters a great deal. So for instance, Atalwa Hassan activists that I spoke to in Morocco agreed with pretty much everything the brothers said about what their mission was, and yet they did not want to get involved in politics, right? They believed that the family and the social sphere were where you had to achieve all of these goals. So I suppose the lesson is there is no one Islamism. And yet also, paradoxically, there are certain shared themes, certain ideas that are in common that we need to think about more broadly, rather than simply saying, you know, more Islam in politics.
That's a very useful and important message. So I wanted to ask you, were there any challenges that you faced while researching or writing this book?
Absolutely. Now, the brothers were a banned movement for a little while when I was studying them initially. So that meant that very few people were, in a sense, authorized to talk to outsiders. So one had to be somewhat creative in trying to get at what they were saying and so on. Also, thinking about one's position as an outsider, as a researcher, was important because a lot of what was being said to people like us was said with an understanding that we would spread this to a wider, probably Western audience. So I did initially find that the leaders that I spoke to had a relatively canned message, and that was less helpful. So, you know, I had to be creative and think about other sources and to try to get at some initial sources. The other challenge, obviously, was in 2011, there was a spirit of openness when I went back, when a lot of people were willing to talk to you, but you didn't necessarily know what they represented within the movement. The movement was changing so rapidly. But one that really made a big difference was the help of a lot of Egyptians, especially reporters, friends, who were willing to very generously put me in touch with people to talk to. That was very, very helpful. Things change quickly, and people have a lot of, you know, PTSD from having been banned. So even in 2012, even when the brothers were in principle the ruling party, there was still a lot of wariness about talking to people like me. And then later on, a lot of the materials that I was able to get, the curricula and so on, you know, after 2013, after the coup, suddenly became banned. And one was potentially going to be criminalized for having access to these documents. So, you know, things change, things go back and forth. But I think that probably those were the everyday challenges. I think one of the things that sets you up well to confront these challenges is to not have one set of ideas about what your sources are going to be. And also just, I suppose, luck. So that's one thing that I suppose I would take away from this. One of the other challenges was that because people's positions could change so rapidly, people that I spoke to were, you know, in jail 6 months after I spoke to them frequently. I did learn that I had to be extremely cautious and respect their privacy and anonymity. So this is something that I think comes through in the book. Almost nobody wanted to be named.
That certainly does come through. Thank you so much for sharing that. Now, we've taken up a lot of your time, so I just wanted to ask you a final question. You know, this book, congratulations, you know, it's out in the world. What is it that you're working on now?
I'm now working on Indian politics again, a civil society organization. So I'm actually learning a lot from the Muslim Brotherhood's experience in grassroots organizing and realizing that this is actually a wider model for all kinds of civil society organizations. So I'm focusing on organizations in India that use economic approaches and educational approaches for social empowerment, mostly among Muslims. And this is something that I hope will ultimately, you know, I hope that the research will be out in a year or two. It's still relatively in the early stages, and it focuses mostly on Western and Southern India.
That sounds fascinating. Well, I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for being
Thank
on the
you.
Show today. The book is Somita Pawa's Politics as Worship, Righteous Activism and the Egyptian Muslim Brothers, published by Syracuse University Press in 2023. Thank you for listening.